This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Coming up on the show, did you know that gender used to determine the legal status of your bartender? Also, Michigan's congressional districts are among the most absurd in the nation, according to a new book by David Daley. And a former Wolverine football player regains his health by adopting a whole food plant-based lifestyle. But first, the legislature is off for its two-month summer break. We wanted to take a moment and look at one of the issues waiting for them when they get back. Joining me to talk about it are Susan Demas via Skype. She's the publisher of Inside Michigan Politics, and Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants. I read an interesting piece by Emily Lawler in the Lansing State Journal that updating the renewable energy mandates is not opposed by the big utilities, as you might suppose, but it is opposed by some politicians. Susan, what do you make of that?
Well, I think that the big utilities, DTE and Consumers Energy, are very interested in the energy overhaul that has been in the mix in the legislature for the last couple of years. I think that they're willing to compromise and go along with the renewable energy standard. They went along with an RPS the last time in 2008. Where the roadblock is that there are a lot of Republican politicians that are not in favor of renewable energy, and a lot of the smaller energy companies are not necessarily on board with the package as a whole.
Now, the legislation pending in the Senate calls for a 35% of the energy generated come from renewable sources by 2025. In the House, it's 30%. But it's not a mandate. It's a goal. No consequence if the goal is not met. Ken, what's the point of legislation like that? And you know, in full disclosure, we should say that a couple of utilities are clients of yours. But what's the point of legislation that's just a goal and not a mandate?
I think the utilities are somewhat ambivalent about the mandate issue. Republicans are not ambivalent. They don't like them. But customers want renewable energy more and more every day. From a utility standpoint, investing in wind and solar helps meet clean air requirements. And frankly, diversifying your generation mix is a good thing. Some coal, some gas, some nuclear, and some renewable. So I think the utility attitude is probably much more ambivalent than Republican legislators.
One of the arguments that's been going on for a while is about competition. Right now it's capped at 10% on a first-come, first-served basis. So a couple of businesses in competition, even across the street from each other, as one I saw in Frankenmuth, where there's a chicken place on one side, a chicken place on the other. One got the free market electricity, the other couldn't. This free market electricity, which could come from out-of-state power companies, is capped at 10%. So why not let everything be free market? That's what we love, right? Why do we have to have restrictions on the free market access to utilities at 10%? Ken?
Well, this is the area that public sector consultants, who I work for, we've done a lot of research on market structure, primarily for the two big utilities in Michigan. So just in terms of full disclosure, I wanted to say that. But this issue of electric choice or competition or retail open access has been vigorously debated around the country now for about 15 years. And part of the challenge in places that have full retail open access, competition or choice, is really reliability. And they've suffered over time from the lack of building generating plants. And it's okay when you have a lot of capacity, which we've had for many years, but now we're getting into sort of short supply, primarily because a lot of coal plants are being retired across the country, particularly in the Midwest. So it's the closure of these coal plants and the challenge of building replacements that puts a strain on this issue of competition and choice.
I don't want to argue with you about this, Ken, because you probably know a lot more than I do about this, but I did see a study this week that came out that said our supply prediction is pretty strong. Susan, what do you think of this this whole argument about free market access capped at 10% or the reliability of the existing utilities?
Well, we did have more of a free market system before 2008. That was a big Republican priority in previous administrations. And when we did our last energy overhaul, which the two big utilities, DTE and consumers, were big driving forces for. The energy choice market was capped at 10%, and the argument then was that it would be beneficial to consumers, it would help lower rates. And, you know, since then, obviously, those smaller companies are not very pleased with the restriction. And there's a much more, I think, amenable legislature right now for that perspective.
Finally, I want to talk about the solar power industry. It's really worried about net metering. The utilities want to change the rates, lower them, pay to solar generating homes and businesses. The solar people say it'll kill solar power developing in Michigan. Ken, what's your take on that? Again, reminding everybody that you represent the utilities in your real job, your day job.
We don't really do much work on this issue of net metering and rooftop solar. That's really what we're talking about, is kind of rooftop solar, individual homeowner solar versus large industrial panels, solar panels. The utilities, both DTE and consumers, are actually investing significantly in the big solar panels. It's this rooftop issue that's caused a lot of debate, and it's a question of rates and fairness, you know. Back in 2008, a system was set up where it's a fairly lucrative, if that's the right word, or easy thing for individual homeowners to do because of the reimbursement rate they get from the utilities. The utilities are claiming that's not really fair the way it's set up, and others have to subsidize that. But they're going to have to wrestle that beast to the ground to get over the finish line.
Right. I know the subsidy argument has been made. Susan, the solar industry says this is going to kill hundreds of jobs in the industry, the just now burgeoning industry of solar, rooftop solar. What do you make of this argument, and what will the legislature likely do?
Well, this is definitely a huge bone of contention in the package. And, you know, what we saw under the Governor Jennifer Granholm administration was a real push for these green jobs, alternative energy, wind energy, solar energy. And that was mirrored at the federal level with the Obama administration. And there were a lot of subsidies to try and push consumers and try and push companies to develop this technology and embrace it. Like anything, there are some unintended consequences. There are winners and losers. And I think right now you have a lot of Republican lawmakers who have never been really supportive of this whole idea of green jobs to begin with, are really focused on some of the losers in this equation and trying to rectify the situation.
That is Susan Demas. She's publisher of Inside Michigan Politics. We also heard from Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants. Thanks very much, guys.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
It's the weekend, finally. Here's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings with our cocktail.
Cheers.
Cheers.
What do you have for us this week?
Well, this week I have a really interesting piece of Michigan history that's going to lead us to the cocktail we're going to taste today.
Okay.
Well, you've heard of Rosie the Riveter, but have you ever heard of Bessie the Bartender?
I have not.
Turns out during World War II, just like women went to work in the automotive factories, they also went to work in bars to keep them running. And after the men came back from war, some of those women didn't want to leave and go back to their jobs at home. But the male bartenders formed unions all over the country, all male unions, to keep women out. In 1945, Michigan passed a law banning women from bartending unless they were related to the owner of the establishment.
Wow.
Right. This was an amazing piece of history I learned just last week. And so in 1948, a pair of women from Dearborn went to the Supreme Court and challenged this law. And the law was actually upheld based on a state's rights law, that the state had the right to segregate their bar rooms to protect women's morality and integrity.
So was this only in Michigan?
No, this was actually all over the United States. And it wasn't until the 1970s that those laws started being struck down. And now women make up 60% of the bartending workforce. So they came back in force.
Well, that's worth a drink. So what are we having?
Well, so one of the arguments given at the time was that this wasn't a moral thing for women to do. And I found this great quote, which is, "Who wants the hand that rocks the cradle mixing whiskey sours?" Well, I certainly do. So that's the drink we made today, is the whiskey sour.
What's in it?
Whiskey sour is just a really basic drink. It starts with 2 ounces of your favorite whiskey. Today we use the Last Feather Rye from Journeyman Distillery in Michigan, but you could use your favorite bourbon rye, any whiskey you like. And then I like it with about 3/4 ounce of simple syrup and 3/4 ounce of freshly squeezed lemon juice, but you can play with those proportions depending how sweet or sour you like your drink. The other thing that I like to do in my whiskey sours is add just a little bit of egg white before I shake it up, and that adds just a nice smoothness, a little bit of foam to the top of the drink, makes it tasty.
So why are you shaking this twice?
Whenever you use egg white in a drink, you want to give it a little bit of extra shaking time before you start diluting it. That's just to make sure that that egg white is nice and emulsified and not slimy.
Well, here's the women bartenders.
Cheers.
The book argues that the Republicans have taken gerrymandering to a whole new level. The author describes the border of Michigan's 14th district as,
"In many cases, the district line is sort of the exact line between hope and despair."
That's coming up in 20 minutes on Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Yesterday, we heard the latest Detroit Journalism Cooperative installment about jobs and poverty in Detroit. One of the experts we heard was Kevin Boyle. He's a professor at Northwestern University and the author of The Arc of Justice, which won the National Book Award for nonfiction. He grew up in Detroit on the city's east side. Rather than just the couple of quotes you heard yesterday, we thought we'd bring you some of the original interview. I was talking with Boyle about Detroit in the mid-1960s and today, and about the Kerner Commission report, which suggested remedies for racial divisions. That report's most famous quote is, "Our nation is moving toward two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal." Boyle said residents today are living that separate and unequal life.
They're facing systems of segregation that their parents faced, that their grandparents faced, that their great-grandparents faced. They're still there. And the remarkable thing about white America is the extent to which whites don't recognize that those institutional arrangements are still in place, that we live in a segregated society, in a society that's segregated not by law. We've eliminated that. That's the triumph of the civil rights movement. But in so many other ways, we still live in a hyper-segregated society.
Give me a couple of examples of things that white people don't see that black people have to live.
Well, there's a really obvious one for a place like Detroit or Chicago, which is where I live, and that's the rate of residential segregation, the extent to which metropolitan areas in the United States are still hyper-segregated. So there's an official statistical measure of segregation for a metropolitan area, not just for the city, not just for Detroit, but for Detroit and its suburbs. It's called the Index of Dissimilarity. And what it does is it basically measures what percentage of the African-American community would have to move in order to make the entire metropolitan area integrated. So if you got a score of 0 on that scale, your metropolitan area is completely integrated. If you get a score of 100, it's completely segregated. The last time they did this measure was 2010. They do it when the census is done. And Detroit, in that measure, scale of 0 to 100, got a score of 78. That's 78% of African Americans in the metropolitan area of Detroit would have to move in order to make the metropolitan area integrated. That's a dramatic level of segregation. That's hyper-segregation. That's one step away from residential apartheid. We live with that every day. And Detroit wasn't the worst city in that. Detroit, I think, was the fourth most segregated city in the United States metropolitan area. Milwaukee was number one, and it was about 81 on that scale. And I will say that that 78 score is better than it was in 1970. So when the Kerner Commission's report was still new, it's better, but it's just not dramatically better. It was at 88. Detroit score was 88 in 1970. In 2010, it was 78.
I want to talk about when the tipping point came and there were fewer whites, or at least there was enough a black population to elect a black mayor. Mm-hmm. So we've seen the city government system, for the most part, is in the hands of black elected officials. You would think they'd have all the political power, but the political power usually has an economic base. You know, The economic power in that city is still owned by the white landlords, the Illiches, Gilberts, and so forth. Yep. So I'm wondering what you think about that idea that the blacks are in control of the city when the whites still own everything.
Well, and you just have to add just one thing. The mayor of Detroit is white.
Fair point. Right.
Right. So when the tipping point in terms of population in Detroit really came in the early 70s. So after the Detroit Rebellion, white flight, which had been going on since the 40s, really intensely since the 1950s, picked up, went to kind of a super level after the rebellion in 1967. The white flight, the exodus became massive. And that's when the community, the city of Detroit became a majority African-American. And that's why Coleman Young was elected in the early 1970s as the first African-American, because that tipping point had occurred. But the economic power in the city did remain. Well, a lot of the economic power simply drained away. I mean, the intensification of poverty in the city of Detroit, particularly in the 70s and 80s, is absolutely mind-boggling, the extent to which poverty took hold of huge sections of the city of Detroit and keeps it to this day. But the economic power was always lodged with major corporations. I mean, it's an auto town. It was lodged with General Motors and Ford and Chrysler, and then with people who had, like the Illiches or now Dan Gilbert, who had massive investment in the city, often land investments in the city. And that's where the economic power is. And I think what you're seeing in Detroit today is very much – I mean, this is really the – to me, the most striking thing about this conversation. You know, you started out the conversation absolutely rightly quoting the most famous line of the Kerner Commission, that we're moving towards two societies, black and white, separate and unequal. And that's what you're seeing inside the city of Detroit today. You're seeing, to a really dramatic extent, an economic revival in the city of Detroit that is not completely white, but is white dominated, and a dramatic level of poverty and inequality for large numbers of African Americans who live in the city.
Let's talk a little further about that. We've had some one of our researchers have been looking at it, and by many of the measures that you can make from the census in 70 to the most recent census now, black home ownership on a per capita basis is down. The inequality between white salaries and black salaries is farther apart for the city of Detroit. There are just a number of things you could go on and on and on, where it appears that the condition of black residents of Detroit today are worse than they were in 67.
That's right.
Does your research find that, and why has that happened?
Yeah, no, it's absolutely staggering. The statistics for the city of Detroit today, for the people living inside the city of Detroit today, it's startling, the statistics. 40% of the people who live in the city of Detroit live under the poverty line today. 60% of the children who live in the city of Detroit live under the poverty line today. 60%. The infant mortality rate in the city of Detroit is 13.3 for every 1,000 live births. That's almost – it's not quite. It's close to triple the infant mortality rate in the nation as a whole. You know, and there's no more sure measure, there's no more dramatic measure of the effect of poverty than an infant mortality rate. The infant mortality rate in the city of Detroit is 6 times the infant mortality rate in Japan. And that's just incomprehensible to me. The level of poverty in the city of Detroit is so, so great. And this was a city that 1970 had a very vibrant economy. This was a place where a person could come. By 1970, you could come into the city of Detroit and you had a good chance with a high school education of making a decent living for yourself and your family. Now, that was already starting to slip. That's one of the things that historians like Tom Segrew have done such a brilliant, brilliant job of showing, that it already started to slip, but it hadn't reached these levels. This is the hollowing out of economic opportunity for a huge portion of the population of the city of Detroit.
So compare the black person's life in 67 compared to today. Give me an idea of an overall view of how they've fared over the couple of generations in about 50 years.
Well, I don't want to sugarcoat it. I don't want to make it sound as if everything was great in 1967, because if it were, there wouldn't have been a rebellion in 1967. So I don't want to overstate it. What I really just want to stress is that Detroit in the immediate post-war years after World War II, so 1940s, 50s, 60s, did create for an awful lot of people, more whites than African Americans, absolutely, avenues of opportunity, not to the middle class. It's one of the great cliches of the post-war period that everybody was middle class. They weren't. What it did was it gave ordinary people, whites much more than blacks, but African Americans as well, a chance to escape the profound insecurity that had marked ordinary people's lives nearly 20th century. So you could come to a city like Detroit, which thousands upon thousands of African Americans did in the 1940s and 1950s, and you would have a chance of getting factory labor. Auto jobs were beginning to open up. There had always been discrimination in hiring, but they had been beginning to open up. So you could go to work in a place like Dodge, Maine, which was still a huge plant in the 1950s, 1960s. And you might have the opportunity to earn a union wage if you got into that plant, to get enough so that maybe you could buy a home instead of renting a home, which is always a better deal particularly for African Americans, because rents tended to be higher for African Americans. They faced walls of discrimination in the city of Detroit, some of which have been torn down. But in terms of economic opportunity, there were more avenues for ordinary people than there certainly are in Detroit today.
You're talking about things like 8 Mile Barrier, but there are still barriers. And there's not the kind of overt redlining of banks and realtors as there was then. There still seems to be some encouragement and direction to put black families in one area and white families in another. There's also this kind of separation of metro transit systems. So it seems like the barriers to opportunity still face, especially if you are poorer and in the city of Detroit, your opportunities are really limited because of limited transportation, limited options for moving out of this situation. It seems like these barriers to opportunities, we've been talking about combining SMART and DDOT for 25 years or longer.
Oh, at least, yeah.
And that never happens. That almost seems intentional. What are your ideas about that?
Oh, absolutely. It's intentional. The great dividing line in Detroit is the color line. It has always been the color line as the dividing line in Detroit. Now, where that color line is drawn has shifted over time. You know, in 1960, Southfield was probably almost exclusively white suburb. It's not anymore. But it's moved. It's not been eradicated. It's moved, and it's moved pretty slightly. And then there are all these institutional arrangements. Transportation is both one of the great symbolic ones. What metropolitan area in that country has two transportation systems, one of which stops at the suburban line? Nobody does that. It's one of the great symbolic divisions in Detroit. But it's more than that, because as you're saying, it also means that if you're living in the center city of Detroit and the job's out in Troy, how the heck are you going to get there? There is a real impact that one simple system, that one system of segregation creates on ordinary people's lives, on poor people's lives. And it's only one. You're absolutely right. It's illegal in the United States to redline. It's illegal in the United States to discriminate in the mortgage market. it's illegal for a realtor to steer an African-American family into or away from a particular neighborhood. All those things happen, and they happen all the time. Because you can make something illegal. You can say you can't discriminate as a realtor in showing a family where a house is. If you don't enforce that law is meaningless. Where's the enforcement mechanism? Except for the incredibly good work that fair housing groups do in the city of Detroit. But those are tiny organizations doing the very best they can against a massive problem. So that system of segregation that divides neighborhoods, those institutional forces, they're still there. And then the biggest one in the city of Detroit or in the metropolitan area in Detroit in terms of housing that we've already talked about is white flight. That's an institutional arrangement. That's not simply that white people are racist. It's that what's happened over 100 years in the city of Detroit and in Chicago and in Baltimore and in other major cities is that racism has fused together with the force of the marketplace, the real estate marketplace. And it's that fusing together that creates an institutional arrangement. It creates an economic incentive for white people who in fact aren't racists to act as if they are. And that's the institutional arrangements just in housing or in transportation that then reinforce these two separate Americas.
When I talk to families on the east side and southwest Detroit on the west side, and I ask them what do you think about that? Doesn't that offer you job opportunities? And the usual response, not always, but the usual response is they didn't build that for me. I can't even afford the parking for a job down there. I don't even go down there. That's Mike Duggan's Central Corridor. That's Illich's. That's Gilbert's. They don't feel that they can even go downtown because it's just beyond their pocketbook. They don't think there's any chance for a job. Or the other thing I get is my friends and I go downtown. We go to Campus Martius. We enjoy it, enjoy the evening, look around us, and it's just so wonderful. And then we have to go back to our neighborhoods and realize what a stark difference it is between that Detroit and my hometown Detroit. I'm sure you've dealt with a lot of research on how you could be so alienated from your own downtown, but I wonder what your observations are on those kinds of attitudes by the folks I've talked to.
I think the second one in particular makes absolute sense to me. I don't think personally that it's a bad thing that core business districts in Detroit is getting the revitalization it's getting, because what it does is over the long haul, if it can maintain itself, and I hope it will, it's going to bring tax dollars into the city. And that's really fundamentally important to everybody in this city. So the city has plenty of space. One thing that city's got, it's got plenty of space. And I think there's nothing wrong with a whole variety of ways to try to revitalize the city that's going to pull in the tax dollars that might help over the long haul to improve city services. So I don't want to be that person who says, oh, that's completely irrelevant to the lives of ordinary people in the city of Detroit. Because I don't think it is. I think there is a connection. I think it's a good thing to see happen. But – and you knew that was coming. But I think people are absolutely right when you're living on the east side, you're living on the southwest side to say, but that's not about me. That's creating that separate world that the Kerner Commission warned about. And it's not reaching in to the neighborhoods. It's not reaching into the lives of that 40% of people who are living in poverty, and it's not going to reach into them except through the way that it might help to rebuild a tax base. Because what the downtown is doing is it's creating jobs that poor people aren't going to get. It's creating high-tech jobs in a city that, by at least one estimate that I've seen, says 47% of the adults in the city of Detroit are functionally illiterate. Now, that's not going to translate into high-tech jobs downtown. When you see the ways that neighborhoods have deteriorated, the way that roads haven't been repaired, the ways that water systems are struggling with, there's so much need in that city that's not going to be met by the revitalization of Detroit. There's got to be ways to bridge that gap between the revitalization, which again, I think is a good thing, and the experiences of people out in the neighborhoods and particularly the experiences of that 60% of the city's children who are living below the poverty line.
That was Kevin Boyle, a professor and award-winning author, speaking with me for the project, The Detroit Journalism Cooperative.
Support for The Detroit Journalism Cooperative on Michigan Radio comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, Renaissance Journalism's Michigan Reporting Initiative, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. There's a new book out about gerrymandering, but it's so much more than that, and it's getting a lot of attention. The author is David Daly. He's with us now. First thing, what are you calling this book on the radio?
The name of this book is Rat F***ed.
Okay. Rat bleeped it is. The subtitle is The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy. Is that in any way hyperbole?
You know, the only word that might be hyperbole there is secret, because the Republicans announced their plan in March of 2010. Karl Rove, in big flashing neon lights on the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal, says that the Republicans are going to use the redistricting process that fall to take over state legislative chambers and then redistrict Congress.
This is Red Map. Can you tell us a little bit more about Red Map?
It's a completely ingenious idea, and the amazing thing is that no one really had hit on it first. Because gerrymandering has been a game that both sides have played since the founding of the Republic. You can go all the way back to, 1790 with gerrymandering. What the Republicans realize in 2009 is that they can use this in an entirely new way if they can understand on a state-by-state level how redistricting works. And then if they set off on a specific strategy in each of those states to control every leg of redistricting so that the Democrats don't have any say in the process, even in states that may be blue states or purple states.
There are several examples, fascinating examples of gerrymandering in the book and how this was done. I want to talk about Michigan's 14th district. You devoted a whole chapter to the 14th district, and you drove the meandering border of that congressional district. What struck you about it?
It's 170 miles. It starts in some of the very poorest cities of Detroit, and it heads all the way up to Pontiac. Essentially, the axis of that district is 8 Mile Road in Detroit, and kind of underneath it, it looks sort of like a coiled snake. And then if you imagine the top half of the district is sort of the neck of the snake reaching up to the city of Pontiac, which is kind of the square head. It is one of the most oddly shaped districts in America. The goal of it is to connect the poor African-American communities in Detroit with the African-American cities up in Pontiac and to pack as many Democratic votes as you can into that district in order to make the surrounding districts more Republican. So Brenda Lawrence takes the 14th with about 78% of the vote, and the surrounding districts mostly fall to the Republicans.
Except for the 13th, which is Conyers, but it's
Conyers
too, right? Yeah,
Conyers wins with 80% of the vote. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the five Democratic districts in Michigan, those are won with 69.9% of the vote. The nine Republican districts are won with 57.7% of the vote. So that's how you get, of a 14-person congressional delegation, nine Republicans, five Democrats. Even though in 2012, for example, 240,000 more votes are cast for Democrats than Republicans, the goal is to pack them into these absurd-looking districts as strategically as you can and waste those votes. And when you drive the district, you see that it makes perfect sense what they're doing. It might look like it's just an absurd line on a map and you might not understand it. Once you start crawling into those turns, you see exactly why they're there.
So tell me what you saw.
In many cases, the district line is sort of the exact line between hope and despair in some of these neighborhoods. You often border the 9th and the 11th when you're in the 14th, which are much richer, wealthier districts. You can take a turn, and the school, instead of looking magnificent in the 11th district, looks completely run down and beaten up in the 14th. You can take a couple of turns and the house values change from hundreds of thousands of dollars to under $10,000. Over the course of the day, you keep seeing these things, and I would see a strange curve on a map, and I'd be like, I'm not going to see anything interesting here. And every single time, it would just make your eyes pop. It's all so specifically done. The technology is so good at this point in time that you can do with exacting specificity exactly what the Republicans managed to pull off. And it does remap our democracy.
You talked to the guy who drew the map, Jeff Temer. What did you make of that conversation?
Jeff is a fascinating guy and a really nice guy to spend as much time with me as he did, knowing I was the editor of Salon and probably had a different political sense than he has. I find that the map makers in these cases love to sort of be gee gosh golly about it all. They try to downplay the importance of what they're doing, even though it's really clear what they're doing. And they try and say, well, it's just there's a county line there, there's a city line there, or I'm not as good at this as everybody else thinks. Except there's one amazing notch in the 14th where if you're driving along 8 Mile on the western edge of this district, there is a small cutout for the town of Farmington. And the town of Farmington is in the 11th. Farmington Hills is in the 14th. But Farmington, which is a town of about 10,200 people, 71% white, really a solid median income. Money Magazine calls it one of the best places in America to live. They had intentionally carved these 2.5 miles out and slide it someplace else. Farmington and Farmington Hills share a state rep. They do not share a member of Congress. This is all being really specifically done in order to place the voters where they want, in order to maximize their share of the total vote when you have a sense in a state like Michigan that you're going to have fewer votes. So you have to arrange where they are in these districts very artfully.
I want to go back to something you were saying earlier. Given the chance, the Democrats would draw the maps to favor their candidates. Tell me again what makes Red Map, this Republican effort, different.
Well, Red Map, to me, is different because the goal was to try and take over states in which they were 50-50 states or even blue states and give them bright red delegations.
So doesn't this just make the Republicans a little more clever than the Democrats? Isn't it that come down to that?
It certainly is more clever. The Democrats suffered a catastrophic strategic failure when they didn't plan for this, have the vision to figure it out first, and execute it. Democrats aren't very good at playing, you know, Machiavellian hardball, as the Republicans often are. But I think we have to take our partisan hats off here and look at this as people who believe in the idea of participatory democracy and to wonder what has happened to that when, say, in a state like Michigan, 240,000 votes more for Democratic candidates than Republicans, but the delegation goes 9-5 the other way. A state like Pennsylvania, where you can have 100,000 more votes for Democratic candidates than Republican candidates, and the delegation is 13-5. And all of that adds up, and it helps give the cushion Republicans have in the House. It changes the kind of candidates that we elect to Congress when we have this many uncompetitive districts in which the only thing that matters is the party primary. So you end up with a more extreme candidate and a more extreme Congress that is less prone to compromise, less interested in governing. And it undercuts the very idea that votes matter and that participatory democracy matters.
So using a term my friend likes to use, how do we get politics out of it? What's the fix? Independent commission, a public contest for the most fair map? What do we do?
It's a great question. We are the only democracy that allows politicians to choose their own voters and make their own lines. And whenever you have politicians in the process, you will have politics in the process. And there have been great experiments with the public drawing maps, say, in Florida. It turns out that the Republican operatives were drawing those maps and enticing members of the public to submit them under their own names. You have a state like Arizona where you have a nonpartisan commission, except it's kind of still a partisan commission. It's got two Republicans, two Democrats, and an independent chair. So there becomes lots of machinations behind the scenes trying to game the system to figure out who the chair will be in a big debate over how each party can try to convince one of their own people to quietly stand in and become a Trojan horse as the chair. It's very, very hard to get politics out of this process. That said, whenever there is a referendum on nonpartisan commissions, they win. Whether it's a red state or a blue state, whether it's Florida, California, Arizona, Ohio, these are popular. I think people understand that we have to fix this. People of both sides understand that our politics have become broken and dysfunctional. Approval ratings for Congress are in the basement. They're often under 10%. And we have to find a way to get a handle on this.
That's David Daley. He's the author of what we'll call Rat Bleeped, the true story behind the secret plan to steal America's democracy. Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Mark Ramirez is a former football player for the University of Michigan Wolverines, and he's not here to talk about sports. Well, we will just for a minute. You were right guard, right? You played. When did you play?
So I played the years 1986 through 1990 for the legendary Bo Schembechler.
So big guy. You were physically active. You pretty much ate whatever you wanted. You stayed healthy. Then you graduated, and without all those workouts and running up and down the field, you started to gain a little weight, starting to have some health problems as the years went by. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so it was about 12 years out of college. I was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. At that point, I was probably about 260 pounds, and unfortunately, I was taking five different medications. And it's no wonder because my entire family struggled, Lester, with diabetes, my entire family.
Yeah, it tends to be a genetic thing. I mean, my father had it, my mother had it, and I understand what you're talking about. How bad did it get for you? You mentioned five medications.
Yeah, so in 2002 that I was diagnosed with the diabetes, you fast forward to 2011, and in that decade of having type 2 diabetes, I had also come down with high blood pressure, mm-hmm. high cholesterol, and I was taking five different medications for that. I was taking two insulin shots a day, two oral diabetic medications, a high blood pressure, and high cholesterol medication.
But because it's a family trait, you know, a lot of people just say, well, this is the hand that I was dealt. But you were offered a gift of a video, and you watched this thing called Forks Over Knives. What is that?
So it's a documentary that chronicles two doctors, one who spent the majority of his career out of Cornell University, and the other who spent the majority of his career out of the Cleveland Clinic. And these two doctors, they're in their early 80s today, Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn and T. Colin Campbell. And what they ultimately reveal in all their years of research and study is how harmful animal foods can be to the human body.
That have an impact on you? What happened?
It absolutely did. So my wife and I, after a decade of being sick, taking these five medications, and you know, I need to mention too, Lester, that on top of the diabetes, high blood pressure, and cholesterol, I also had erectile dysfunction. I had psoriasis all over my scalp. I had heartburn all the time, and I was tired very often. So we watched this documentary. We read Dr. Neil Bernard's program for reversing diabetes, and these two actions changed my family's trajectory forever. Once we adopted this lifestyle in December of 2011, after, again, being sick for a decade, I was off all five of my medications in 2 months, and in 3 months, I had lost 45 pounds.
Now, you were off your medication. This is after you checked with the doctor, right?
Yes, working with the doctor and seeing my blood work. And again, as a diabetic, we're frequently checking our glucose levels multiple times a day, injecting the insulin. So I could see 3 to 4 days into this lifestyle of going plant-based, my sugars just plummeting and really starting to lose weight, and I was feeling so much better.
Now, by nature, I'm a skeptic. I mean, I'm a reporter. So we've all heard about these miracle diets, these exercise regimes. How is this different than some of those?
Here's the funny part about this. In that decade of being sick, I had tried to count carbs, count calories, portion control, exercise more, eat less. And while I may have realized some benefits, I lost a little weight, or maybe I even felt a little better, I was never able to eliminate the medication. So it wasn't until I changed the food, went to and adopted a whole foods plant-based lifestyle that I started to see immediate impact with my results and ultimately eliminated all five of those medications in 2 months.
Now, I read in your bio somewhere that you had talked to your doctor earlier and you asked him when you first had to start taking insulin injections, how long am I going to have to do this? And he said, forever.
That is correct.
So when you came back to him and all these changes had taken place in your glucose levels, in your blood pressure and cholesterol, what was his or her response?
He was actually amazed because I did ask him, Doc, will I ever get off this medication? And he flat out told me, you're going to be on insulin the rest of your life. And so when I came back to him and said, hey, Mark, you're the poster child for a type 2 diabetic and you are my star patient.
Everybody's metabolism is a little different. Is there evidence that everybody can benefit from these changes that you've made?
There is so much evidence. I mean, there's five different doctors that we love and follow and have been doing this for decades, Lester. This is not new information, but unfortunately, there's a lot of marketing about a lot of the foods out there that most Americans eat, fast food. I mean, everywhere you turn, there's marketing for all this fast food, and unfortunately, it's a lot of unhealthy food.
But I can imagine the meat processors and the pork industry and the cattle industry are not happy with you right now.
Well, you know—
And the dairy industry, and can I go on?
It's big business, right? And unfortunately, I have nothing against any of those industries, but what I do and try to promote is being healthy and seeing what has happened to me. And Lester, we've been having chickpea and bean, we've been having free meetings since January of 2015.
Yeah, tell us what that is. This is the nonprofit corporation that you and your wife started. What does chickpea and bean do?
Our mission statement is to help educate people about the power and benefits of a plant-based lifestyle. We've seen such dramatic change in our family here immediately. And I've also had so many other people since then that have adopted this lifestyle, Lester, that they've eliminated medications, lost weight, felt better. And we see so many people around us. And in fact, we are continuing this. And pretty much Chickpea and Bean is a nonprofit organization. It's my wife and I, like you said. I'm Mexican, so I'm Bean. She loves chickpeas, and she is chickpea, and thus we are Chickpea and Bean, and that's our website, chickpeaandbean.com. Everything is free on our website. There's nothing for sale. We're doing this to try and inspire others to really think about food as a way of healing themselves.
Now, I can see that you are thoroughly convinced that this is the only way to go. I wonder, though, if you think that someone could do primarily what you do, just cut back on animal fat, cut back on the cheese. I mean, is a way to do this in moderation, or is the only way to get the kind of results you got is the way you're doing it?
I think, Lester, that if I had one burger a month or a little bit of animal product here and there, I might still be not quite as healthy, but I think that you could realize a lot of the benefits. However, I think about moderation, and I think about many of us struggle. A lot of this food is addicting, cheese in particular. I hear about cheese, oh my gosh. A lot of these foods are addicting. So what I tell people is if you can just figure out a way to cut it out, plus there's also so many substitutes for a lot of these products that are out there today that you can purchase.
We've been talking with Mark Ramirez about the health benefits he's seen by switching to a whole food plant-based diet. He's inviting people to see what it's all about. There's an event this weekend in Saline. You can get more information at chickpeaandbean.com. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Lester.
Stateside is produced by Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, Ali Billings, and Lindsay Scullin. The executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.